Rachel, you know, just this week, I heard yet another news report about a county where 40% of rape cases were given quote-unquote exceptional clearance, a term meaning case closed without prosecution. And that just sunk my heart. Sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes in this country, and the statistics are terrible. I was just looking online this morning. Every 73 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted, and it happens most to the age group 12 to 34. You unfortunately fell into that group. Talk about how this underreporting, how this resistance to prosecution affected you and how this all unfolded in your life.
Yeah, you're right. Those statistics are incredibly sobering, and they're something we need to do a much better job grappling with in society. You know, I have a lot of people ask, you know, were you afraid of Larry when you reported? And in my case, I wasn't afraid of my abuser. I was afraid of the detective I would get and the prosecutor I would get, because as a trained attorney, I knew that's where it typically broke down. You know, the statistics on how survivors are treated when they disclose, even by law enforcement, how many rape kits are actually even sent out for testing, you know, after the victim undergoes such a traumatic exam. And then how many cases ultimately wind up prosecuted are just incredibly sobering. And then if you even do get to prosecution, the likelihood of getting conviction and a jail sentence that is commensurate with the type of crime that's been committed, you know, those are all just incredibly uphill battles that survivors face. And I was very keenly aware of them, you know, and I get the question all the time, how do you teach survivors to report? How do you help survivors report? You know, and the answer to that really is you make it safe for them to report. You make it worth it for them to report. And that has to start with how we respond to survivors when they report, how their case is investigated, and how well that case is prosecuted. Rather than putting the burden on survivors to just up and report, we need to make it safe for them to report.
Tell us about this new book that you have, What is a Girl Worth? The whole process of exposing yourself in the courtroom to all the media that took an interest in your story. Why go even further and write this very personal, very powerful book? And tell us also about the title.
Yeah, so it was quite a process to decide to write the book, because you're right, it was a very difficult process, and it wasn't one that I wanted to undergo. You know, it had already been traumatic enough to go through a couple of years just in the media all the time and with the case of the media all the time. But I really felt like there was so much people needed to know and understand, and honestly, such an incredible story to be told, because it's a story of how you take control from two major organizations that were shielding an abuser. It's a story of a team that came together at just the right time, all the factors that had to come in place, all the evidence that had to be found, the way the story had to be put together, the prosecution, the investigation, all of it. You know, it's an incredible story of triumph and also an incredible warning about all the things that went wrong. And so those were all dynamics that I wanted to be able to draw out in the story. You know, in addition to that, I felt it was incredibly important to really to tell the truth about what a girl is worth. Mm. You know, and that's where the title comes from, because that was a question that I asked every judge I was in front of when I had the opportunity to speak on behalf of other survivors and speak on behalf of my case. What is a girl worth? Because ultimately, everything we do, every decision we make, affects the people around us. And whether those are small decisions or big decisions, we have to grapple with how much the people around us are worth. And so part of that book is examining some of the ultimate life questions that all of us have to face. You know, and it is also a very emotional question for me, because that was what I asked my husband every night. You know, as an attorney, I would read through, you know, all of the court documents and the indictments and, you know, all of the paperwork that laid out what Larry had done, not just to me, but to so many other survivors, and, you know, the descriptions of the child porn that he had on his computer. And I would read those things every night after I put my children in bed, so that I would be up to date on where the case was at, so I could interface the next day with reporters and help them put their stories together and understand the facts and move the case forward. And so after my kids would go in bed, I would look over this information and I would just stand in my kitchen and I would weep. And I would say, who is going to find these children? Who is going to find the little girls on Larry's computer? And who's going to tell them how much they're worth? And that's what I wanted to do. I want my story to be not a story about me, but I want people to read it and realize if this is what it took one person, one white woman from a middle-class family who's educated as an attorney, and this is what it took her and cost her, how much more does it cost the survivors who don't have that kind of support system, who don't have the media presence, who don't have the access to a good investigator and a good prosecutor? And to hear those survivors' voices coming through the story, because they need us to be advocating for them.
You spoke for yourself, but you spoke also for many, many women and girls. And in reading your book, I was struck with how intensely you approached this, with what detail, with what devotion you brought this to the courtroom. And I thought you had an advantage in that you went on to train as an attorney. You had that legal expertise. In one sense, the book is empowering. And in another sense, I thought, wow, what if you don't have that expertise? You mentioned also a support group, but you brought all this knowledge.
Yeah, and that was something that weighed on me very heavily throughout the case, was just that dynamic that, you know, looking at how difficult it was, emotionally difficult, physically difficult for me to do what I did, and realizing that I was put in that position because of organizations that continued to harbor an abuser, that continued to silence women, that made it necessary to come forward so publicly and be willing to be an international news story. Nobody wants their sexual assault to be dinner table conversation across the globe.
Yeah.
It's the worst position to be put in, but it had to be done that way. And I would, you know, and as I was going through that, that was one of the other things my husband and I kept discussing, is just, what do the survivors do who don't have this, who have never seen the inside of a courtroom, who don't understand what a cross-examination is, you know, and who don't have the legal training?
Yeah.
Because again, those are the survivors that need us. They need our advocacy. They need our voices. They need us to be looking at the legislation and how our courts work and how investigators are trained. You know, what kind of resources we have available for survivors to pursue healing. There are just so many factors that they need us to be advocating on. And I really wanted to draw that out. I wanted people to see what it costs so that they would translate that to the survivors who don't have a platform, who don't have anyone.
There was a line somewhere in the book about takes a village to raise a child, but you went on from that saying. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that actually was a quote from one of my favorite movies, the Spotlight film, which followed, of course, the investigative journalism team that uncovered the sexual abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. And that film just does an incredible job highlighting the cultural messages that we need to see. And there's a scene in there where the attorney who is trying some of these cases says, mark my words, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to abuse one. And what he was referencing there is the way that we all collectively choose silence, the way that we choose not to advocate, the way that we choose not to see, the way that we choose to support the abusers over the victims. And that really is a dynamic you see again throughout the Larry Nassar story that I really wanted to be able to draw out. It's just all of the failures, you know, and to take readers behind the scenes into what it took to put the case together, what it was like to be in the courtroom, all of the things that people don't normally get to see and hear and understand from a sexual assault case, and to bring readers into those moments so that they would see and hear and feel and understand what was going on, what it took to get us to the point where 156 women came forward and gave victim impact statements. Because it took years to get to that point, and people need to understand, you know, the amount of effort and just the incredible story behind how we got there.
Why is it that sometimes it is so difficult for outsiders and even the victims themselves to identify assault? What is it that you want the reader to understand about that?
I think one of the first things we need to understand is that assault often doesn't look like we think it's going to look.
Hmm.
We have a lot of preconceived notions about what sexual abuse looks like. The guy in a trench coat in a van with no windows. You know,
right.
It's kind of our preconceived idea. It's the guy who's creepy. It's the person who's the social misfit. But that's not usually who an abuser is. More often than not, an abuser is someone you know.
Mm-hmm.
They are able to abuse you because they have access to you through a relationship. And B, they're highly skilled manipulators, you know, or they're in positions of power. You know, and you see this in a variety of ways, whether it's campus sexual assault, childhood sexual assault. It's the people that would make you go, oh, he would never. Or someone who's in a position where they know they're not going to be touched. you know, a star athlete or someone with a really stellar reputation. Those are the types of people who abuse. And because we as a society so often doubt the disclosures of survivors and we place blame for the abuse on survivors, what survivors ultimately do to try to feel safe is they do the same thing. They place the blame on themselves or they try to minimize what happened to them because they're given those minimizing messages over and over and over again in society. And that makes it very difficult for the survivor to even trust their own instincts, to be able to say, this is what happened to me and it was wrong and it's not my fault, because everyone around them is telling them that they did something wrong. They should have done something better if only they hadn't, or that their abuser couldn't possibly be an abuser. And survivors absorb those messages too. They know they're on their own. And so they start to parrot what they're hearing because it feels safer that way than to fight everybody around them.
While you seem to get tremendous support from some, you've mentioned that already, probably most of all Jacob, your husband, and your family, at times you found yourself ostracized, even by one of your churches that you belong to. Talk about that.
It was, unfortunately, it is what so many survivors face when they speak up. And in my case, with the second church that we lost shortly before I filed the police report, it wasn't advocacy in my own case. It was advocacy for other sexual assault victims. And it was a classic case of community protectionism, that it was an organization that had repeatedly failed to report childhood sexual abuse, that had mishandled allegations of sexual abuse, and just done incredible damage to many survivors. But when we raised that as a concern for our church's affiliation with this other organization, you know, the immediate response is, well, of course they wouldn't. They would never. It's fine. You know, and the inability to really see through people who look like they are good people, who look like they're doing the right things, and to realize that actually sometimes people we like or trust or respect or look up to do really do terrible things. And also, you know, I think we do have a problem with understanding what enabling looks like. Mm. Oftentimes we think of people who enable abuse as, you know, men sitting in a cigar, you know, smoke-filled room, smoking cigars, and saying, oh, child abuse is fine, I'm not going to do anything about it. But that's not often what enabling looks like. Sometimes there is, and there often is, very malicious enabling. You see it in the, you know, excellent example is the Roman Catholic Church, where they knew exactly what was going on, and they moved people around intentionally to hide up the abuse. You certainly see that.
Yeah.
But you also see people who are very committed to their ideals, that believe they're doing the right thing. And this is what you often see in religious organizations, particularly Protestant organizations, that really believe they're doing the right thing. And so being able to explore those dynamics, why we mishandle abuse, how abuse gets mishandled, and the ramifications on survivors when abuse gets mishandled is, again, just an incredibly important dynamic that I wanted to be able to draw out in the book, because it's a pattern that repeats over and over and over again. We simply see it blown up under a microscope in the Larry Nassar case.
Faith, at the same time, was a great source of strength for you. That definitely comes through in your book. At the conclusion of the book, you address your abuser by telling him how one can earn forgiveness. And you talk about faith and that it isn't through good deeds. It was a very powerful statement. And I don't mind telling you, you brought tears to my eyes more than once reading it. I wonder if you could talk about that powerful statement that you said to him. At the same time that in that statement you said you could forgive him.
I think oftentimes we portray justice and forgiveness as dichotomous, like they're opposed to each other. But the truth is justice and forgiveness are really dependent on each other. And that was something that I felt was very important to draw out in the victim impact statement. Justice needed to be done because these women were worth it. The little girls that Larry had harmed were worth it. And justice demanded the strongest prison sentence to send a message about how much these women were worth and how much the damage had been done to them. But at the same time, because of my faith background, I do also believe forgiveness is possible. But I wanted Larry to understand where it came from, because during the court process, when we would have preliminary examinations or court hearings, Larry would frequently bring his Bible into the courtroom as if, you know, almost as if sending a subtle message, you know. And when he stood and spoke for his sentencing for child porn, the child porn conviction, he talked about how he prays for his victims at night and how he's seeking forgiveness by doing good things. And I felt it was very important that he understands that's not where it comes from. You know, this isn't a balancing act. Doing good things doesn't erase the bad things you've done. Those bad things are still there. And I felt it was important to communicate to him where true forgiveness comes from, and that there aren't enough good deeds he can do to outweigh that forgiveness. But forgiveness is available when there is true repentance.
Yeah, it was that talk about repentance that you said.
Yeah.
I thought that was just really powerful.
You know, it requires facing the reality of what you've done and being honest about it, which is something none of us really want to do. You know, all of us want to be better than we really are. And again, I think you really see the impact of those little decisions that Larry made, you know, and the little decisions that all of us made. And you just saw it blown up under a microscope. All of the self-justification, you know, just it was right there in the courtroom for everybody to see, that desire to not be who he really was.
How important do you feel it is to have a chance to give those victim impact statements in a courtroom to speak to the person who has transgressed against you? How important a part of healing is that?
I think it's incredibly important. I really think there are two sides of that coin, though, because the honest answer is I had reached a very good place of healing before I came forward, and I think that was necessary in order to be able to do what I did, to know that my healing and my identity weren't dependent on whether or not I saw justice. They weren't dependent on the response I received from my abuser, and they weren't dependent on the community's response, that I could speak the truth about what happened to me. I could acknowledge the evil. I didn't have to minimize it. And I could learn to grieve the damage in ways that were non-destructive. And so I do think healing is possible without that. And I think it's important that we recognize that, because most survivors will not get what we got. So it is possible without that. That being said, I think it is an incredibly important step in the justice system, an incredibly important step whenever we can make that available for survivors. Because one of the worst things that's taken from you in abuse is the ability to use your voice. Your choice, your decisions, your will, and your ability to speak are all taken from you. And so to restore that to the survivor, to restore them their power and their dignity, is an incredible way that our justice system can really do what it's intended to do, to bring justice. And I think that's something, you know, one of the philosophical things that we really need to grapple with coming out of the Nassar investigation. You know, there was definitely pushback from some communities about the way those sentencing hearings were held and the number of women who were allowed to speak, and that they weren't given time limits, because not a lot of judges do that.
Yeah.
But it was really integral. And so to ask that question, you know, when we say our court systems are for justice, what does that mean? To have a more fully orbed perspective of what justice means. And part of justice is the restoration of what was taken. And the ability to give a victim impact statement helps to restore the voice that was taken from you. I think it's an incredibly important part of the process.
How do you look at Michigan State University? Have they done enough in terms of reparations and how they've treated this situation, and perhaps also the world of gymnastics?
And the unfortunate reality is they have not done hardly anything, and certainly nothing willingly.
Yeah.
And we have asked for a few very simple things over the last few years, and they're the same things that I ask for my children. Yeah, I've got four young children. They're 8, 5, 4, and 16 months. And if one of them does something that harms their sibling, I require them to say, "I am sorry that," and to identify exactly what went wrong and that it did this to you, to identify the damage they did, and then to ask, "How can I restore the relationship? How can I help you feel better?" You know, and those are very simple steps. Identify what went wrong, identify the damage that was done, and ask how you can work together to repair the damage. You know, and MSU hasn't done any of those things voluntarily. They have yet to publicly identify anything that went wrong.
Yeah.
And that was something I asked in my victim impact statement. I listed all of the times that employees at MSU had failed to report direct allegations of abuse against Larry, and said, "Is this the right way to handle abuse on MSU's campus?" And over again, they've refused to answer that question. You know, so they have not identified the damage. They have refused to do an in-depth independent review and make the report public. USAG has refused to do an in-depth independent review. You know, and the change that has been forced without their willingness. In the case of USAG, they still believe they have a publicity problem. The last two appointees that they appointed were both under investigation through their own organization, their Safe Sport organization, for abuse in the gym, for physical and verbal and emotional abuse in the gym. And even though there was an ongoing investigation and numerous allegations against these appointees of abuse, they still appointed them head of athlete safety and head of the medical department. You know, so they really do believe they have a publicity problem. If you cannot acknowledge the problem that you have, you cannot fix that problem. And we just seem to be stuck there with both organizations, USAG in particular. And that's deeply troubling.
Your children are still very small. You have daughters and a son. Along with this book, you've also written a children's book by the same title. So I'm wondering also, maybe you can talk a little bit about that book, but also with all that you've gone through, what do you tell or what will you tell your daughters and what will you tell your son?
Yeah. So the girls' book was written, and it was really my heart's cry, not just for my daughters, but for every little girl that I can't save.
Yeah.
Because it was written to tell them how much they're worth. Where does your value come from? Where does your identity come from? Can it be damaged by something someone does to you? Yeah. And I think it's incredibly important to have those foundational conversations with our girls and with our boys, because they are constantly getting the message, both boys and girls are, that their identity and their value and their worth comes from something that they do. From an athletic achievement or from an academic accomplishment or from their skills that they have. And they need to know that their value is intrinsic to who they are and that it's not dampened or removed by something that's done to them. And so my hope with that book is that it will be a conversation starter between parents and their daughters about how much their daughters are worth and how we teach our children where their value comes from and where they find their value. And we have those discussions all the time with our kids. You know, they are young, so of course they don't know very many details at this point in time. But we look a lot at foundational concepts that will mature with them as they mature. So we look at principles of consent, principles of bodily autonomy, principles of privacy, principles of value and how much you are worth. And we teach those foundational principles and we have very open dialogue and discussion, you know, about all of those things. I ask the question, what are those, you know, what is it for? What are your hands for? What is your voice for? What are your private parts for? Because I want my children to understand both that they are to be protected, you know, and that they, that their privacy and their right to consent, all of those things are important and they will be protected. I also want them to understand that the purpose of their own bodies is to help protect others, you know, and so we ask both of those questions, understand both their own value and their own purpose so that they can be proactive in standing up against an abusive culture or a culture of injustice. You know, and having those foundational concepts in place will allow those discussions to mature as their knowledge of sexuality matures and ages with them.
Important lessons. I plan to pick up that book for my granddaughters and grandson.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. So to bring this to a close, I want to ask you, Rachel, how are you today? Is healing possible?
It is. Healing is possible. But I also think it's important that we define healing properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of survivors feel a lot of false guilt when they still have some symptoms of abuse, nightmares, or flashbacks, when they still need counseling or they still need medication. And I think it's incredibly important to understand that healing is possible. It comes. It gets better. There is much, much hope. But to also understand that there are always going to be scars, and healing does not mean that you become like you were before you were abused. I think a better definition of healing is that you know what to do with the pain when it comes. You know how to grieve and how to process in ways that are not destructive to you and to the people around you. So you want to, it's important to understand that hope, that it gets so much better. It really does. But it's also important to not put false guilt on survivors or a false expectation that if they just do it right, they will be as they were before they were abused. Again, you have to hold both of those intentions. Healing is knowing what to do with the pain when it comes.
Well, I hope you know that you've become, through your experience, a blessing to many others. The women in that courtroom that you gave the courage to speak up, and I'm sure to many, many readers that you may or may not hear from who read this book.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you for having some time set aside for us, Rachel. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a good discussion.